Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen talk radio show. My guest for this morning is Nancy Beckerman. She is the author of the newly released book titled Out of Time, One Couple's Journey Through Cancer. It is a chronicle of her life's experience dealing with her husband's four-year battle with cancer. Out of Time explores in a loving, real, and powerful way how the Beckermans' lives changed and how they confronted each challenge with dignity, perseverance, and courage. Good morning, Nancy. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
Fine. Thank you, Johnny. It's great to be with you today.
Wonderful. Your book is very powerful and moving. It is
thank
beautifully
you.
Written from the heart for the heart. Personally, it was very difficult for me to read the last few chapters because it brought back memories of what my mom went through
sure.
with my dad's passing some 30 years ago. Congratulations for the release of your book. Let us start by getting to know you a little better. Please give us a quick walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
Okay. I would say, Johnny, that my life up until the point of my husband's diagnosis was a fairly normal, average life. I grew up in a suburb of New York, and I had a small family. I had one brother. And I went to college in upstate New York, met my husband during the summer while I was in college, and we got married after about 4 years. I had two daughters, and as you can see in the book, my husband was a physician, so I had various jobs before he actually opened his medical office, and after that, I ran the office with him.
Mm-hmm.
So we worked together for a long time, and that was the way things were going. I did have other interests and hobbies, which I pursued, but that was the way it was up until his diagnosis. And actually, at the time of his diagnosis, our children were young adults.
That's very interesting. Your book tells a very compelling story, a very intimate story of you and your husband's journey during the most challenging times of your life. Please share that story with us.
Sure. Of course, when anybody gets a diagnosis of cancer, it's a shock and devastating, in fact. And since my husband knew a lot about medicine, more than the average person, I think it was a little harder for him. We decided to seek medical care in New York City because his type of cancer was kind of rare. And from day one, we connected with a wonderful doctor. And we followed all of his advice, and my husband had many procedures and many rounds of chemo. And we just kept fighting this battle. However, I must say that that is not all that we had in our lives, because our doctors and the nurses encouraged us to do as many so-called normal things and to take as many little vacations and to have as much joy in our lives as we could in between all the medical events.
Reading your book, I realized that you have a bunch of support group around you, from doctors and, of course, families played a key vital role in the things that you guys were doing. But what's interesting, you decide to keep a journal. Why is that?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, I didn't start the journal until we were about a year into the whole experience.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was I was keeping all the facts in my mind. And after a while, there was just too much going on for me to remember all the details. So I started writing it down, and actually I found that a great release. I found it very cathartic to write it down. And then as I wrote, I realized that it would be helpful to me and to perhaps others
mm-hmm.
if I wrote down not just the facts, but other things, how we were feeling at the time, what things we did that we found helpful and what things were not helpful, what things were not worth bothering with. So I started keeping it for myself, but also just to keep a record for so we would know in the future and so other people would know mm-hmm. what might be helpful.
Mm-hmm. One of the things also, whenever one goes through sort of a challenging times like that, there are many things we don't think about. I mean, certainly we don't plan for death. We don't plan for acute illness and so
right.
forth. So
right.
tell us the experience that you went through in terms of going through the process of, wow, you know, understanding that this is now, this is real. I have to be in the present moment, so to speak.
Right. Actually, it took a little while for me and for us to get there because we discovered this, that something was wrong while we were on vacation. And so when we came home, my husband saw his doctor immediately. But his tumor was not typical. So for, I would say, about 2 months, nobody knew what it was. None of his doctors knew
mm-hmm.
because it was not typical. It happened to be a tumor and a blood clot, so it wasn't acting like either one.
Mm-hmm.
And my husband had learned many years before that in medical school that there's a type of cancer called sarcoma, which is a tumor of the soft tissue or the muscle. He learned that if that's what you have, that's it. Yet, that knowledge belonged to the medical part of him. The human part of him, or the personal part of him, wanted to deny that.
Mm-hmm.
So on the one hand, we went all summer with him saying, oh, if this is sarcoma, I'm a dead man.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, he was saying, I'm not going to the cancer hospital because I don't have cancer. So I thought that was so interesting. In hindsight, I see that that's so interesting. How mm-hmm. a person that intelligent and that knowledgeable about medicine can still be in denial when it comes
mm-hmm.
to himself.
Mm-hmm. We're never good doctors when it comes to ourselves. So that's one thing I realized.
Right.
I do have some physician friends, and when it comes to something yeah. like that, yeah, they and again, it's I don't think it's a wrong way of thinking, but they feel
right.
like, you know, it doesn't happen to me.
That's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. We were lucky enough to finally, when we went to the cancer hospital in the city, the first doctor we encountered turned out to be a wonderful person who helped us for the entire 3.5-4 years. And it was his encouragement and his wonderful attitude that kept us going and kept us positive and even helped prop us up when we got discouraged.
Mm-hmm.
And we were very lucky about that.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure there were many moments of those roller coaster rides as well when you
sure.
go through such a trauma like this.
Yes.
When did you decide to turn your private story into a public book?
Yeah, that was a pretty hard decision. First, I was writing it for myself, and then I thought, well, it will be for my family. But as we went along, I found that I was seeking out books in the library that were other journals or other people's accounts of how they had gone through this,
mm-hmm.
not necessarily the same kind of cancer or not necessarily even cancer, but just how couples had gone through something like this.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that very comforting because when you are going through this, no matter how much support you have from friends and family, you still feel isolated. You don't want to tell friends everything. I mean, it's too much for someone else to hear, really.
Yeah.
So I found that reading other people's books or journals made me feel, wow, I'm not the only one. Other people have gone through this, and it is possible to go through it and still maintain a positive outlook, a healthy outlook.
Mm-hmm.
So gradually I began to think that it might be useful for other people to read, and then I started thinking about making it into a public book.
Very interesting. Who do you intend the book to be written for?
Well, I guess first just for my family,
mm-hmm.
but then I was hoping that it would help other people going through not just illness, but any adversity, really. And then I realized that everybody has adversity. And in fact, the first few people who read my book were family members. This was before it was published, mm-hmm. and I wanted their opinions. And they read it, and they said to me, they were a little surprised because they said, this is not depressing. This is not a downer. This is a love story.
Right.
I was really shocked at that because in my mind, that's not what I was intending to write. I was intending to write a story that showed how you could get through a difficult situation.
It is true, but I have to agree with them. It is a wonderful love story.
Thanks. Thank you. That it's very nice to hear. I just hope my intention and my hopes for the book are that it will help people who have to go through any kind of a difficult experience.
I'm sure it will, because there's no question about it. It's a difficult book to read in the sense that, you know, people tend to read books for a happy ending or mm-hmm. this and that. And I think it just depends on how you look at life, because your yes. book is very spiritual, very inspiring. It gives us an opportunity to walk through life and understanding that when it's all said and done, we are all connected. There's more to life than just the material side of things. There's a definite human connection here, and so it makes a big difference. What are some of the treatments that your husband had to undergo?
Well, since his treatment did go on for almost 4 years, there were a lot. And, of course, the first thing he had was surgery, mm-hmm. and that was followed immediately by radiation because that was determined at the beginning that this was what would happen. And I will say that when he went into the surgery, nobody knew what we would find. The tumor was in his leg muscle. Mm-hmm. So the best possible outcome would be that they removed the tumor, period. The worst possible outcome would be that he died or that they had to remove his leg. Luckily, they were able to remove the tumor. And then he had radiation. And that went on for a couple of months. After that, he had, over, I guess, the next 3 years, he's had several courses of chemo with many different drugs. Some of these were very successful, and then we'd have a period of time where he was feeling good. Some of the chemo drugs were not so successful. He had other procedures. He had what we call a port or a metaport put in, and that was something that is put in under your skin. And that is where they can deliver the chemo rather than putting into a vein in your arm.
Mm-hmm.
At another point later on, he had something called an embolization. At this point, the cancer had spread to his liver, and they were trying to cut off the blood supply to the tumor in his liver. So these were various procedures that he had. When we started out, he was a very healthy person, and I think that that is what helped him do so well through all these procedures.
Mm-hmm.
Because after each procedure and after each round of chemo, he was often feeling pretty good, and we could enjoy things like taking walks or vacations. So mm-hmm. in that way, we were very lucky.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. You made a transition from being a wife to a caregiver.
Yes.
I'm sure it was sort of a conscious decision to do that, but it was subtle at the same time. Tell us about that.
Well, sure. It was gradual. So, of course, it just took a while. And since my husband was a doctor, he always knew more about the medical side of things than I did. Mm-hmm. So I couldn't enforce my decisions on him. Usually we agreed on all his decisions, but there were a couple of times when, for example, he was in pain for one reason or another, and if he had not been a doctor, I would have said, okay, let's get in the car, you're going to the emergency room. But he made the decision that he did not want to go, and I said to myself, he's a doctor, and he's the patient, and he knows how he feels, and so I would defer to him.
Mm-hmm.
However, once I did become the caregiver, a lot of jobs became my job that used to be his job, such as mm-hmm. doing most of the driving. And it's very funny. Some of the things that happened were very funny, and thank goodness mm-hmm. we kept our sense of humor. He started doing the dishes. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that he never did the dishes before he got sick, but once he got sick, he realized that I had to do a lot of things that he had done in the past. And so he thought one thing he could certainly do was do the dishes.
Mm-hmm.
So for the last 3.5 years of his life, I never washed a dish. And that just strikes me as so funny. Mm-hmm. But it was kind of nice. You know?
Right, right. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
In your book, you talk about fear. The illness is part of life, that you cannot hide from it. Hiding
sure.
only isolates you anyway and encourages fear. And
yes.
I thought you masterfully overcame fear within yourself. How did you mentally prepare yourself for the subsequent events that follow?
Well, I hate to say this, but I guess a little denial doesn't hurt. Early on, I was given some advice by a friend of mine who was a cancer survivor.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you look at the overall picture, it's just overwhelming. My friend said to me, just look at what has to be done today or mm-hmm. right now. And that is a very good way to deal with the fear. Not to think about the eventual outcome, but just what do I have to do now? What has to get done today to help us fight this battle?
Mm-hmm.
Also, I have to give a lot of credit to our doctor because he was our cheerleader. And, for example, when we first met him, from what my husband knew from his medical training, once you have the diagnosis of sarcoma, there's nothing that can be done. But in the intervening years between my husband's medical school and when he got diagnosed, there had been a lot of discoveries. And so the doctor, my husband said to the mm-hmm. doctor, if it is sarcoma, is there anything you can do for me? And the doctor said, oh, of course, there are many things we can do. That was so welcoming news. That
mm-hmm.
was just so great to hear. And we felt we were in good hands. And that helped with a lot of the fear. Oh, there's another thing I should say. This was a very good point, too. We had the habit of swimming in the morning,
mm-hmm.
at least when my husband was healthy enough to do it. One of the men my husband was friendly with in the men's locker room was a psychiatrist. And early on, the fear was very, very great in our minds.
Mm-hmm.
And my husband's friend said to him, this is what happens with fear or with any panic that you have. The mind cannot stay in that high state of alert or the high state of panic for
mm-hmm.
too long. Your mind just automatically learns how to deal with it, and the panic will lessen. And so from then on, whenever we would either get a bad report or hear some bad news, we would, of course, feel fear and panic.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say to myself, I know this isn't going to last. My mind is going to adapt to it. And that helped tremendously. And it is true.
How interesting. You went through several phases yourselves in the journey.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
among which, actually, you mentioned in the book about the fact that you had a biopsy done.
Oh, me, myself, you mean?
Yes.
Yes. Well, to tell you the truth, anything that I had to have done was just so minor compared
mm-hmm.
to what my husband was having that, yes, at one point I had to have a biopsy, and luckily the results proved that it was, you know, nothing.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't even think about it. I mean, I suppose it could have turned out to be something difficult, but I didn't even think about it because what my husband was going through was just so much bigger that that was what we focused on, really.
Mm-hmm. What were some of the most challenging moments?
I think that the most challenging moments mostly came near the end or any time that we did receive a bad report or a bad test. When those moments happen, there really isn't much you can do. You just try to gather all your courage and say you'll face it and do whatever the doctors recommend. You'll just do whatever has to be done. there were times when we faced a good report, and that was just exhilarating and wonderful. Normally, when we faced a bad report, we did contact our doctors because they would then tell us what the next plan was going to be. But our doctors never lied to us, but they did always try to put the best spin on it. I will tell you there was one doctor we had to deal with who didn't have the best bedside manner, but he was so intelligent and he had such knowledge about certain chemo drugs that we needed that we needed this doctor. And the doctor who was managing the case, who was such a wonderful person and actually very, very funny, he would say to us, as soon as you come out of the other doctor's office, give me a call. And we did that because every time we came out of this other guy's office, we were devastated. And I was very angry at this other doctor. But then I realized he has so much bad stuff to deal with in his life, and he's chosen to work in this field. Maybe this is the only way he can deal with it. You know, maybe he can't be a cheerful person. But we had a lot of ups and downs and just tried to focus on the ups. By the way, this is not an attitude that I might have had beforehand. I learned this from our doctors and nurses.
Very interesting. Now, one of the trips that you took that was very memorable, and I thought it was very spiritual in nature for sure, and I'm sure you would concur with this conclusion, is the trip to the Grand Canyon. Please tell us a little bit about that.
Well, what can I say? The Grand Canyon is, to me, the most beautiful place. I find it very spiritual. It just does something to me. And luckily, I've been able to keep going there. My husband had been there before I had been there. And so the first time he took me there, actually, we got there. We arrived at night. And it was just shocking. It was pitch black, and you looked down and you knew something down there was big and dark. But we continued to go there throughout his treatment whenever we could. And I think it just brought us peace. It's so removed from everyday life. And it's just, I don't know, there's some, well, if you love nature, I can't imagine you not loving the Grand Canyon. It's funny because we had been there frequently, I would guess once a year for many years, and there's a woman we got to know who works there, and I still know her, and I still see her when I go. And I've always thought to myself, wow, wouldn't it be wonderful to work at this place and to wake up every morning and be able to see this beautiful view, and it's like you're looking into the center of the earth. I don't know. Some people look at it and see a hole in the ground. I look at it and just see, to me, the colors are beautiful and the sky is beautiful. And at different times of day, it looks so different. To me, that's one of the highlights of my life is going there.
Were you and your husband spiritual people at all prior to all this happening?
I guess I would have to say no. I always loved nature, and actually we both always loved nature, so in that way we were spiritual. But during this whole period, I became much more spiritual. And then during his death and then after his death, I've just become more and more spiritual. And that's been a huge change in my life. And it's something that brings me a lot of peace.
In your book, you also mentioned about while going through the process of addressing the issue about your husband obviously having cancer, one of his patients' wife had cancer, and apparently her husband had cancer but had survived over the years because of stem cell transplants. I don't know whether you recall that particular story.
Sure.
And you ran into her in the supermarket and here her hair is dropped, you know, it's falling off, basically. And it kind of gave you a sense of hope in the sense that, you know, going through and seeing other people and again, that's being present in the present moment, so to speak. So share that story with us, please.
Well, this is something that really inspired me. And I guess all along the way, when something inspired me, it would just sort of be like a light bulb going off. Mm-hmm. Here was a woman whose husband had had cancer long before my husband got it. And they had been going for treatment over the years. And then in the middle of all that, she got it. And I thought, oh, it is taking all of my resources to deal with my husband's illness. If I got sick too, I just don't know how I would do it. Mm-hmm. And this person was not someone you would look to and say, wow, that's a really strong spiritual person. She seemed like just your normal, average, everyday person. Mm-hmm. And yet she was dealing with it. And when I saw her in the supermarket, she was so happy because she had just finished her chemo. Mm-hmm. So I was looking at her being totally shocked because she was bald. Mm-hmm. But she was thrilled because she had just put this behind her. And that I found really inspiring, because if you see someone dealing with much more than you have to deal with, and she's doing okay and smiling, you mm-hmm. think, you know, wow, it can be done.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That brings us to the support that you receive.
Oh.
How much support did you receive from your families and friends?
I think I received an awful lot of support, and it was truly life-saving. I hate to keep harping on the same thing, but I do have to say that the support we got from our main doctor was life-saving, mm-hmm. mainly because he knew more than anyone. He was familiar with the illness, and he was the most cheerful. But aside from him, friends and family were wonderful. And a very strange thing happened. My husband, being a doctor, he was a very independent person. Mm-hmm. And people would look at him and think he was very strong, and he was. And so we didn't feel a lot of sympathy pouring in before mm-hmm. he got sick.
Mm-hmm.
After he got sick and people knew that he was sick, and if they came into the office and saw he was bald because of chemo, you would not believe the outpouring of good wishes
mm-hmm.
that we received. It was just amazing. And I realized that these good feelings on the part of other people had been there all along.
Mm-hmm.
But if you appear to be strong, or you appear to be independent, people think you don't need to receive these good feelings or good wishes.
Right.
If people think that you need it, they're more than happy to step up and help in any way they can.
That's part of showing the vulnerability of oneself, and it's very
yeah.
difficult. Very,
yeah.
very difficult.
It is, and I think my husband and I both tended to be independent, and we like to be in control. And near, you know, not only near the end, but I guess all the way through, I found that sometimes I had to ask people for help.
Mm-hmm.
And, oh, boy, did I hate to do that. I just
right.
didn't like doing that. Until someone pointed out to me that the person said to me, how would you feel if someone asked you for help? And I said, well, I'd feel great, you know. And
that's
she said,
right.
See? So don't be afraid to ask other people for help.
Right.
That was good advice.
Definitely, because we live our lives governed by love and fear.
Yes.
We love to give. We're fearful of receiving.
Oh, so right. That's so right.
For those who want to support a friend or a family member battling cancer, what are some of the things they can do or say in this case?
Okay, there are many, many things you can do. And I would say, however, in my opinion, the most important thing is to be there and to listen if the friend needs to talk. There are so many people, and I have to include myself, who, when they know that you have cancer or you have some other big problem, they're afraid to come over. They're afraid to call you. They're afraid to bring up the subject because they just think it's so unpleasant, or they think, oh, gosh, I don't know what to say.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that only serves to make the person suffering even more isolated. I think that just being there is so valuable, and, of course, offering to help in any way you can. But I can just give you one example. There's someone I know who is going through this now, and her husband was diagnosed with cancer. And I still may not know what to say to her, but if I say good morning and just say, how's it going, and I just don't run away, but I say it like I really want to hear an answer, she will just start talking. And it's like, wow, maybe no one has asked her, or maybe nobody has wanted to listen all day or all week. So I really think that just being there, showing up and being there and being willing to listen is really, really, there's just no value you can put on it. It's invaluable.
It's very interesting that you suggested that, because that's a very tough thing to do. I know personally for myself, and not necessarily in a situation where I encountered people that are terminally ill, but it's very difficult, because what do you say? Well, in the grief process, so if someone already passed on and you go to a wake or a funeral, what do you do?
Well, it is difficult, but I've been in that situation even recently, and some of the things are even so strange, they're comical. But I remember being with someone who was, her husband had passed away, and I went to the wake, and I just was standing there and saying, you know, I'm so sorry. And she started saying these things that to me were just absurd, but apparently it was important for her to say this stuff. And her husband was, it was an open casket, and she was saying, oh, doesn't he look wonderful? And I'm thinking, my mind is saying, what? You know, what?
Are you crazy
here? That was very comforting to her. It wasn't anything I said. It was just whatever she needed to say. So I just said, I just kept agreeing with her and telling her that, you know, letting her say whatever she wanted. And I could see that that was making her feel good.
It's true. The fear that I finally overcame, in the sense that the fear of, like, it's okay that you can't do anything, but just being there.
Yes. Well, that's the other thing about control. We all like to have some measure of control, or we all like to try to fix things to make them better. And gosh, you know, sometimes you can't, whether it's somebody who is sick or someone who can't find a job or someone whose car is broken down. You know, sometimes you can just be there and be a friend and sympathize. You don't have to fix it. In fact, this is very funny, because I remember for years, many, many years ago, there was popular talk about the difference between men and women, how they mean different things with their words. And I remember having this issue with my husband. I would complain to him about something, and he would tell me how to fix it. And that's, I found that so annoying. And finally, I realized I'm not asking him to fix it. I know how to fix it. I'm asking for sympathy. I would say to him, when I tell you blah, 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 what I want you to say is, oh, dear, yes, I want you to put your arm around me and give me sympathy. I know how to fix it. I can fix it. I just want someone to say, yeah, I know, that feels rotten, doesn't it? But it's so funny, because we do have this need to make things better and fix them.
Well, we feel helpless, because you're telling me something, and so under circumstances like this, it's like, I wish I have the magic wand to make it okay. And sometimes it doesn't work that way. One of the things going through the process that you went through with your husband, and again, we come back to the idea of the various support groups from doctors, caregivers, and so forth. Hospice played an important role. And so people don't talk a lot about that. And of course, it's a difficult thing to talk about, but I thought you covered fairly well about hospice in the sense of the journey that you all went through. Please share with us with regards to the role of how hospice helped you guys.
Well, actually, we didn't have hospice for very long. When my husband really did start to go downhill and severely, where we knew it was really the one-way trip, we got hospice quickly then, but that was, I think, only about 2 weeks before he passed away. But it was just amazing because we had used up most of the treatments available to us.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had used up all of the treatments available. And then our doctor from the cancer hospital and our local doctor both started saying we should call hospice. And I think I know now that they had been talking to each other. But mm-hmm. anyway, we called in hospice, and it still didn't register in my mind that this was the end. It was, mm-hmm. again, it was just denial, you know,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
which I tell you now is not a bad thing.
Right.
But anyway, one wonderful thing about hospice is that they are so skilled at what they do. And, of course, the patient and the caregiver are not skilled at end-of-life issues.
Right.
It is great to have them come into your home and be concerned with the comfort of the patient and making the patient feel better. And they know certain things that the average person really wouldn't know unless you had been through that already.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so that is comforting. And another thing that our local hospice did provide was they provided grief counseling afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
So the experience before he died and after was really made a little, a little more comfortable by the hospice organization.
How do you suggest people cope up with loss of loved ones?
Okay, that is a hard one, but there are a few things I think are very important. One is that everybody grieves differently,
mm-hmm.
and you have to do what feels right to you. You have to take your time. You have to do it on your own timetable. There are many people, lots of people, who want to tell you what you should be doing and what you should be feeling. That is baloney. Everybody feels it differently, and everybody does it at his or her own pace. And that's fine. That's the way it has to be done. There are no rules. And I feel so strongly about this because I've had so many people tell me or tell other people what they should be feeling,
mm-hmm.
or that what you're feeling is ridiculous, or not ridiculous, but maybe what you're feeling is not right. You
mm-hmm.
should be doing this now.
Mm-hmm.
You should be getting rid of this, and you should be doing this, and you should be going out. And, you know, you can't force yourself to do anything. And I saw with someone else in my family who did not grieve properly.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess that's a ridiculous thing to say, grieve properly.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't allow herself what she needed to do to grieve. And so, therefore, she never got over it.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until years later, when someone else died, that the grief for her previous loss came out, and it was overwhelming.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I would just say, only you know what has to be done and what feels right to you, no matter how long it takes. You just do what feels, of course, if you seem to be locked in depression or something like that, there are places to go for help.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the way to cope is just to listen to your own heart.
Very true. You mentioned also the fact that you were on this spiritual journey because the closer it got towards the end, you were on a spiritual journey of some sort. What are the things that you do to find solace on your own?
Oh, me personally?
Yes.
I have tried to listen to some of the lessons I've learned,
mm-hmm.
such as to listen to my own instincts and listen to my heart. I've tried to be open to new things. I've tried to enjoy what brings me joy, such as happiness, nature. This may sound funny, but there are certain corny movies I love. And I just try to be who I am. You see, I was very young when I met my husband. I was 18.
Mm-hmm.
So you could say I never really had the chance to grow up on my own.
Mm-hmm.
And then later in life, whatever it was, 40 years later, I find myself alone. Well, I'd never lived alone. Once I met him and got married and had children and started working, I never realized all the things that I could do or might like to do in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And when I found myself alone, very slowly, I started adding things to my life. And in a way, it's a little bit of a thrill to see, wow, I can do that. I didn't think I could do that. Look what I'm doing now. You know, it's, wow, am I really doing this? Not only doing it, but am I enjoying it? Mm-hmm. Oh, this is another thing about dealing with loss. I guess people think they shouldn't enjoy their lives after a loss too
mm-hmm.
much.
Mm-hmm.
Well, nobody would ever give you the advice that, hey, you've got to be miserable because you had a loss. You know,
right.
That is
right.
So wrong. In fact, the person you've lost would never want to be looking down at you being miserable.
Very true. What would you like your readers to gain from reading Out of Time?
Well, I guess there are a lot of things. I guess I would like them to realize that there is joy in life no matter what you are facing. And that I know sometimes we can feel guilty if we are enjoying something when we really think we're supposed to be suffering. But the more joy you can have in your life, the stronger you get to bear some of the things that may come your way. I think that I've tried in the book to point out some of the people I found inspiring. And in fact, now I do try to look for that in all kinds of people. There are ways many, many people can inspire you that you never maybe would have looked to those people for inspiration in the past.
Mm-hmm.
I would just like people to read the book and feel that you can deal with something you thought you never could deal with. There is reason to be hopeful and optimistic. As long as we're on this earth, we have things to be grateful for. And another thing I learned from our doctor is to not look back and not look back with regrets. Because,
mm-hmm.
for example, we would always say to him, oh, gosh, what if we had come in sooner, or what if we had done this or done that? And he would say, doesn't matter. This is where we are today. We're going forward from here. And these are things that you can use forever, you know, no matter what you're dealing
right.
with in life.
Right. Well, the what is, it never happened.
That's right.
And so what we have is the present moment and what you're going to plan tomorrow.
Yeah, that's
and so
right.
That's a big difference. And also, as part of treatment of this kind of a nature, the importance of keeping our attitude in a positive mode, I'm
yes.
sure that helps as well.
It does help. I don't know if it helps the outcome, but it helps the patient and the caregiver. Because
right.
we did. This is one of the questions we asked our doctor, because I really don't think my husband was as optimistic as I would have liked him to be. So one time we asked our doctor, do you think that the patient's attitude can change the outcome? And he answered very honestly, and he said he really didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
I know that if you're positive, it makes your day better.
Right.
But I don't know if it makes the outcome better. Nevertheless, I still think it's so valuable to have a positive outlook. If you can. You know, you just
mm-hmm.
have to do your best.
Right. Where can someone go to buy your book, get more information about you, and keep up with your latest happenings?
Well, the book is available online on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, but you can go to the website for the book, which is called www.outoftimebybeckerman.com. That's all one word. And there is a link to where you can buy it. You can also read the first chapter. And there's a little bit about me on that website also. So that would be a good place to start.
What is the web address again?
It's www.outoftimebybeckerman.com. All one word.
Wonderful. How has writing this book helped you in your journey?
It has helped me so much in so many ways. As I said at the beginning, it was really cathartic and a big release to write it. Once I wrote it down, I felt I didn't have to keep it all in my mind. Mm-hmm. And I've heard from other people going through this that they did keep journals. I also was kind of surprised at how much I wrote and how well it turned out, mm-hmm. and how well people have received it, because to me, I was just scribbling my own journal. But then when people read it who have been going through this and they find that it is very helpful to them, that's amazing to me. That makes me feel great. And that's one of the things that I've now sort of added to my life that wasn't there before, that mm-hmm. I would have had no clue, me being an author, you know, mm-hmm. what are you kidding me? But here it is. And people are saying to me, well, what's your next book? Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, whoa, wait a minute here. You know? I mean, you never know what's around the corner.
Right. Well, it is a wonderful love story, besides the fact that you are helping people to understand how to deal with such difficult moments in their lives. So
yeah.
For that, it's a very unique blend mm-hmm. of presentation, so to speak, from your end.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Any final thoughts about the book?
Well, I guess one big thought is, one main thing I've learned is that there's never too much kindness or love or compassion in the world. There's plenty of reason to be angry or sad or bitter, mm-hmm. but that doesn't help. My final thought, I guess, would be to keep as much of those good feelings, love and kindness and compassion. Not only does that help the person you're giving it to, it sure makes you feel better too.
Mm-hmm. Very true. How has your children reacted to the book?
Oh, that's so interesting. Of course, my kids lived it with us. They mm-hmm. were not living at home at the time. They were both adults. And one lived in New York City, so she was an hour or so away. But at the time, the other one was living in Alaska. So they were not right here in the house while this was happening. I sent them each a copy of the book, and I think they find it very difficult to read. And I don't blame them, mm-hmm. because I find it difficult to read also. And since they lived it, they don't need to relive it.
Right.
I told them I want them to have it. I don't care if they read it now or later or never. I just want them to have it. And they both are very, very curious, and I know they've both started to read it. I don't know how far they've gotten. You know, it's
right.
really very close to them, you know.
Very true. By the way, we're coming close to the end of the show. Mm-hmm. Do you have a recipe for living you would like to share with all our listeners this morning?
Sure. Here goes. I would say be open to new experiences. A positive outlook, optimism never hurts anybody. I'm not saying to be unrealistic, but to focus on the positive is really helpful. There's always joy to be found, no matter what your situation is. And as I said before, don't look back with regrets. Also, I've learned to have faith that I'll be able to deal with whatever happens. And it's important to know that you can't control everything, and that's okay. There's another very, very important lesson I learned from our doctor.
Mm-hmm.
He told us this one day when we were just talking, and he said, I'm not afraid to fail. And that hit me like a ton of bricks,
mm-hmm.
because up until that point in my life, I had been afraid to fail,
mm-hmm.
and I had spent my whole life studying and working and trying so hard not to fail. And here's this man who's brilliant saying, mm-hmm. I'm not afraid to fail.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, boy, what would I have done or what could I do if I wasn't afraid to fail? What would you try? Good heavens, you know, there's no limit on what you would do if you weren't afraid to fail.
Very true.
I have one more thing to say.
Yes,
and this is really
ahead,
funny,
yeah.
because it comes from my habit of eating chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the chocolate I eat has little sayings written inside the wrapper.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one that I love so much. Miracles only happen to those who notice. So if you're distracted or you're too worried to pay attention or you're just being sour or angry at something, mm-hmm. you're not going to notice the miracles that life is handing you. You got to pay attention, keep your eyes open for the miracles, and appreciate them when they come, because they're there.
We got to know what chocolate is that, so that I could go out and buy a dozen of it.
Well, I only eat Dove chocolate. I only eat dark. And inside each little individual piece is another saying that's great.
Mm-hmm.
But that's my favorite. Miracles only happen to those who notice. They could miracles could be sitting right there in front of you. If you don't open your eyes, you're not going to receive them.
You have to live in the present moment when it's all.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. And the other thing is to never stop laughing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because without a sense of humor, life can be mighty grim.
I sense you have a wonderful warmth of sense of humor with you, and that's fascinating. I think that obviously permeates throughout your entire family, even before this whole process happened, mm-hmm. and I'm sure that has helped tremendously while you went through the process itself, and certainly after the fact as
well. Yes, yes. Yes, and our doctor did too, and I remember sitting in his office one day. You know, we were scared. And he just was sitting there with this smile on his face like, yeah, we're going to do our best. Don't worry. We're going to help you through this. And I thought, wow, if he can sit here in a cancer hospital with that smile on his face, well, I'm going to go with that, you know.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Nancy, what do you have planned for next year, 2012?
Well, I have to get back to my artwork. I had to put it on hold while I gave a big push to this book this past mm-hmm. summer and fall. And I'm putting that idea of my next book in the back of my mind, because a lot of people have said to me, what's your next book? And I started mm-hmm. out by saying, no, I have no more books. And mm-hmm. my daughter whispered to me one day, yes, you do.
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking, well, you know, I'm not going to rule it out. So I'm going to think about that.
You have been touched in some ways from a spiritual standpoint of view, the things
yes.
that you've gone through.
Yes.
And you may very well be used as a vessel to get certain information out there to everyone else.
In a way, I feel that that's true. In a way, I feel that it's my job now to tell everybody what I've learned. And in fact, someone has suggested that my next book would be how I got to where I am now from where I was the day my husband died.
Mm-hmm.
And I hardly feel like the same person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I guess a lot of stuff has changed. And maybe it is my mission to get that out there. You know, maybe that could be helpful to people.
Wonderful. And any final thoughts?
Let me see. I think to have faith in yourself. And this is another thing a friend told me. She, at one point in her life, she realized, I think I have the strength to deal with whatever life throws my way.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to know what it is in advance. You just have to have a little faith in yourself.
Wonderful. Well, Nancy, thank you so much for the great recipe for living you had shared with us earlier, and for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join me next Tuesday morning. My guest will be award-winning columnist Christopher Feniglio. Christopher and I will be discussing about his life's work and his latest Christmas poem, Kristen and the Santa Secret. For additional information about this show, future shows, and to receive a free recipe for living, please go to FromMyMamasKitchen.com. Thank you for listening and have a great week. Nancy, thank you again and have a great day.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.